Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller. It seems like interest in using native plants in home gardens just continues to grow, and it's no surprise since we have a lot of qualities to recommend them. And it's good to have you along for another edition of Garden Talk as we talk native plants today with our guest. Guy that knows a lot, Neil DeBull from Prairie Nursery, comes by a few times a year to talk with us about how to use native plants and why you should appreciate them. And Neil, always a pleasure.
My pleasure, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
We have lots of things that you and I can talk about. And, of course, we want to take calls from listeners. If you have a question or comment for Neil, you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And while you're there, you post a photo. If you got some nice photos of your plantings, your native plantings, we'd love to see those as well. Anything, you know, this crazy winter we've had, is there any concerns here?
Well, it's been a pretty cold winter. I think it's the coldest winter since 1994, if I have my statistics correct. And, you know, we had, 38 days in Madison where the low temperature hit zero or below. We're going to miss the 40 number. We're not going to make it there. It'll put us in rarefied territory. I think only, 6 years that's happened, since 1869. But anyway, I think everybody's tired of that, so they don't want to set records. But your herbaceous plants, which don't have living material above the ground like woody trees and shrubs, are probably going to be okay as long as they are, you know, adapted to our climate and you're not planting something from a very far southern zone. Because we've had pretty good snow cover, and that's the trick. Everybody complains about the snow, but my goodness, that's what preserves the plants, especially herbaceous plants, because it keeps the soil warmer, keeps it from experiencing such extremes that can really harm plants. It's those cold, open winters, especially if we have a dry fall.
Because
without moisture in the soil, then the moisture just zooms down in the soil. And it's the rate of change, not necessarily the extremes, but it's the fast rate of change that really hurts organisms. So I think we're going to be okay mostly with our herbaceous plants.
Got some frost down there pretty deep. I heard 6 feet in some places.
That's really interesting. Under areas where the snow has been removed, yes, you've got frost of 6 feet. Now, we had a most unusual experience this year where we had this antiquated buried pressure tank in our house, and the pressure tank switch froze and the pump ran and blew up the pressure tank, so we had to have our backyard excavated in February.
Oh no.
Yes, but it was fascinating because in my yard I have our no-mow grass because I hate mowing the lawn. Underneath the no-mow, which I let grow about, it was 6 inches tall. And so it has all these air spaces in between the leaf blades, which provides a layer of insulation. And then there was a foot and a half of snow on top of it. Underneath all that, there was zero frost in the ground.
Wow.
No frost whatsoever.
And, of course, now you have no no-mow lawn either.
Now I have a big, giant mess. But I got water.
But you got water.
12 days without water, it was like high-class camping.
Oh, boy.
I said to my long-suffering spouse, Aquila, and I said to her, hey, look, we got heat. We got, you know, beds instead of sleeping bags on the ground. This is class action here. You know, we're good to go. But it was amazing to see where you had that insulation on the ground. Zero frost.
Oh, man. Well, some native seeds do need extra protection for successful planting and germination. I know that. You've talked a bit about that?
Yeah, as far as like pre-treatment, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, seeds are smart. They have these little brains inside them, if you will, that prevent them from germinating at the wrong time and really try to set them up for success. For instance, let's say you're a typical wildflower seed and you're ripe in October. Mm-hmm. And your seed falls on the ground, and it's 65 degrees in October, and it's raining, and wow, this is perfect conditions for germination. Now, if that seed germinates, it's got maybe a month before it gets really hit by cold weather, maybe a month and a half, and that seedling is probably going to die. So almost all of your seeds have a built-in mechanism that requires them to be exposed to cold weather to, quote-unquote, turn on the seed for germination or to break dormancy. Most of your in fact, pretty much all your prairie grasses can be overcome. The seed dormancy can be overcome with what we call dry stratification. Mm-hmm. Stratification is a term used for exposing seed to cold temperatures like 34 or 35 degrees, usually for 30 to 90 days, depending on the species. Most of your prairie grasses only need 30 to 60 days of cold treatment. You just put them in a Ziploc bag in the refrigerator, and that will usually break dormancy, thus stimulating germination. Some of your flowers, however, need what is referred to as moist stratification, where they are actually moistened or dampened slightly. You don't want them sopping wet, but we put them in a inert material like clean sand, sawdust, peat moss, something like that, just slightly damp, enough for the seed to absorb the moisture, and put that in the refrigerator for 10, 30, 60, 90 days, depending on the species. That mimics the effects of being in the ground over winter. So the seed now, after being exposed to the cold temperature, says, oh, I went through winter. And then when it warms up in spring, it's safe to germinate.
So that is very cool.
It's very important for survival. And, of course, these plants have been doing this for a long, long time, so they know to do that.
The interesting thing there is we've often talked, I've talked with many people about the fact that some seeds need these cold treatment, but we've never really said why. And that was a perfect little explanation. I love that explanation of why those seeds need that cold treatment.
Survival. And there are some crazy seeds that like to take it a step further.
Yeah.
A couple of them. For instance, there are seeds that are what we call double dormant. Okay. Most of your wildflowers, let's say you plant them in the fall when they're ripe, they'll come up in the next spring. But there are some, especially members of the lily family and the rose family, the seed dormancy will not be broken with one winter. It has to go through a winter, a summer, and a second winter. Thus the term double dormant. They have to go through two winters.
Wow.
So if you want to propagate rose seeds, you got to fake them out. You put them in the fridge for 60 days, and then you take them out for 60 days, and you put them back in for 60 days, and you can usually get them to germinate. Or you just put them in the ground and wait 2 years. The same with trilliums and the smilacinas, the Solomon seal and false Solomon seals, polygonatums. These are all double dormant, and they will drive you crazy in the propagation department.
I would think so. And then And so you kind of go the natural route in terms of planting those seeds then, too, and everything, don't we?
There are advantages to planting a prairie from seed, both in the spring and in the fall. Each has its own advantages and drawbacks, and it really depends on what your goals are. Let's say, for instance, your goal is primarily prairie flowers, because many of the flowers do best with this period of exposure to cold, damp conditions, i.e. planting them in the fall, so they experience winter as they would in nature. You will get significantly higher germination on many species. Not all the prairie flowers require this, but many of them do. Some of them, like, say, shooting star, if you don't do this, you will get exactly zero germination. And you expose them to 30 days of moist, cold treatment, you get 100% germination.
Wow.
It's just amazing. So by planting in the fall, you get higher germination of flowers. But many of your warm season grasses, such as big bluestem, little bluestem, Indian grass, side oats grama, these typically will exhibit much lower germination when dormant seeded in the fall. So if your goal is primarily prairie grasses, you don't want to plant in the fall if you can avoid it. You want to plant in May or June because most, depending on the prairie grasses, most of your prairie grasses are related. They're warm season grasses. They're related to corn. So you plant them when farmers are planting corn, May or June.
Nope.
A few of them are exceptions. The cool seasons, they need to be planted in the fall for best germination. Grasses like prairie drop seed, June grass, and needle grass. These do better with fall planting.
Neil DeBole, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery. It's always great to have him along as we talk with him about maybe a little bit about getting native seeds ready for plantings. And, of course, talking about your prairies or your potential prairie. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Ryan and Toma's been waiting a while, so let's go to Ryan. Hi, thank you for waiting.
Hi. I have a question about starting downy flocks and lupin. I work on establishing wild species for local sand mines. And as you may know, downy flocks is a very, very expensive seed. We're talking about thousands of dollars a pound. And I would like to be able to give my customers their money's worth when it comes to this high-dollar seed.
Yeah, you have a very good point there, Ryan. The lupine is easy. The downy phlox is a little more difficult. You know why downy phlox is so expensive is because the seed pod explodes. Actually, both lupine and downy phlox have exploding seed pods. Lupine is a little bit easier to time the collection of, and each plant produces significantly more volume and weight per plant. Downy phlox has a small seed. Yep. When that seed is ripe, the seed pod explodes. Thus, to collect that amount of seed is very difficult. That's why you're paying hundreds of dollars an ounce, thousands of dollars a pound. So really, the best way to handle downy phlox would be to do the dormant seeding in the fall and let nature take its course. And it takes a long exposure to moist, cold conditions in order for it to germinate. So if you just throw that seed on the ground in the spring untreated, you're probably not going to get very good results. Also, it is a cool early spring plant. And so this is a very important factor, is the timing of your seeding. If you plant that, you could do all the pretreatment you wanted, 90, 120 days of moist stratification to break seed dormancy. But if you plant it in June, it's probably not going to come up because it typically germinates early in the spring in April when the temperatures are cool and the soil is cool. So that's another reason why planting in fall for some of these difficult species, you take all the guesswork out of it and you let nature take care of it for you. So you want to time your site preparation so your area to seed is ready to go, free of weeds, any soil amendments you need to add to it or add it to the soil prior to seeding, and then plant it in the fall as a dormant seeding. And if it's on a slope or an area that's subject to erosion, you want to plant it no later than October 1st with a nurse crop, such as oats, annual rye, something like that, to help hold the soil temporarily to make sure you don't lose the soil and the seed. Lupine.
Is there any way to pre-start it for spring at all?
I'll tell you what. We grow almost all of our plants from seed at Prairie Nursery.
Yep.
Downy phlox is one of the few plants we do by cuttings. Because it's such a pain to collect the seed, and the seed is a little bit tricky. So, yes, you can pre-treat it, but make sure you've got it in the ground. I would have it in the ground no later than April 15th if you're going to do that.
Yeah.
Lupine is easy. Moist stratify it for 10 days in the refrigerator at 34 degrees. No longer than 10 days, it wants to jump out of the bag. And it will start to germinate in 14 days right in the refrigerator at 34 degrees. It's crazy. So you can get like 99.9% germination by just 10 days of moist stratification. Or you can plant the seed fresh right after it is produced, usually collected in late June or early July. What it does is it will sit in the ground for the summer and then germinate usually late August and then form a small plant to go into the winter, just like winter wheat, if you will, where it grows part during the fall during cool weather, and then the next spring it'll come out of the ground and really get going.
There you go. Good luck. Thanks, Ryan, for calling. Appreciate it. I'm going to give Kathleen and Delavan a chance to join in. Kathleen, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to put out my annual bid for partridge pea seeds, which Neil sells, I am cold stratifying them as we speak. They are an amazing plant for bumblebees. So anybody who's trying to attract pollinators, you could even put these in a pot, and then they'll reseed themselves. They're annuals, and they reseed, and they're beautiful. They bloom for at least 2 months.
Yes, it's a wonderful plant. And have you grown the wild senna also, the perennial?
I have those as well, and I have just a city lot.
Oh.
But there, I have some wild senna, but the partridge pea, people actually stop and ask, what is that beautiful yellow flower? And it's only like, you know, less than 2 feet tall, and the bumblebees are just, it's just a mass of bees every day.
Yeah, the bumblebees and bees just, and other pollinators as well, love the members of this genus. Well, they used to be, they've changed all the names around. They used to be cassias. Now they're sennas and chemocrysta. Don't worry about the Latin. It's all mixed up, and who cares anymore?
Yeah.
But, they do need to be cold stratified for a short period, and it's so simple that anybody with any kind of garden can grow it, and it comes back, and it's easy. You know, nothing to do to take care of it.
Well, that's great. I'm glad.
I just wanted to put in my pitch.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathleen. And I was just, you know, I grabbed your a copy of your latest catalog to look here. Is a partridge, is there a photo of a partridge? You got photos of so many hundreds. And of course, I'll ask this and you'll say, well, no, not this one.
No, not this one. And you know why? Because it's the only annual we sell. Every single plant in our catalog is a native perennial with a few biennials and one annual.
One annual.
And you know what they say, friends don't let friends plant annuals. But But this is the exception because exactly what Kathleen said is such a wonderful, wonderful plant. And of course, because it's an annual, it only flowers for 1 year, but it does self-sow readily onto open soil in adjacent areas.
So you get new ones.
Yes, as long as it's not a solid sod where there's no openings for it. So.
Neil DeBole, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking native plants, prairie plants today with Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in today. If you have a question for Neil, are you a prairie plant person thinking about getting started in that area? Do you have a favorite one? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page if you've got some cool photos of your prairie. Love to see those. And a question, you can also just post it on my Facebook page. We had a general interest question, I think, here from listener Chris, who wants to buy milkweed seeds to help the monarch butterflies. What's the best kind of milkweed? Where do you get it? And what do you need to do to prepare the seeds?
Fantastic question. It depends on your soils and your goals as far as which milkweeds you purchase. The wonderful thing about the genus Asclepias, which is the genus of milkweeds, is that there are many, many species that will grow, depending on the species, that will grow in very dry soils, in medium soils, and even in moist soils.
Oh.
And when you look at supporting the monarch butterfly, which is dependent upon members of the milkweed genus for its food as a caterpillar, you want to make sure that you're planting the best species for it. Now, of course, the common milkweed is the one that everybody knows. You see it growing along the roadside. And this is really one of the most important plants for the monarch. And one of the reasons that the monarch butterfly appears to be in such terrible decline is that we're losing the common milkweed. Whereas previously, that was one of the weeds that farmers couldn't kill.
Yeah.
Now they can. And so the cornfield that was full of milkweed is no longer full of milkweed. The soybean field that had all the other weeds killed out except milkweed now has no milkweed. And so there's millions of acres of corn and soybeans in this country, and there went a huge amount of habitat. So unless that changes, we have to plant more milkweed, or we're going to lose a monarch butterfly potentially.
Well, they're a pretty plant. Why not?
Well, they're weeds because they creep by rhizomes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, really honestly, the common milkweed is not a really good garden plant. It does tend towards the thug side because it likes to creep and crawl and take over. But there are many other wonderful milkweeds. For instance, if you have a dry soil, you can plant the beautiful butterflyweed, which does great on dry sandy soils and sandy loams. If you have a moist soil, you can plant one of the favorite milkweeds for the caterpillar of the monarch, the red milkweed or marsh milkweed, Asclepias incarnata.
Ah.
This is a preferred food. And another plant, say you have a woodland. Okay, we don't carry this plant. I hope to soon. It's called the white or the woodland milkweed, Asclepias exaltata. This is another premium food for the monarch butterfly. In fact, I grow a little bit of this at my house, and the monarchs just demolish it before I can even get much seed off of it because the caterpillars typically, not last year, but typically they're all over it because it is such a tasty plant for them. So you want to make sure you also have a wide variety of flowers throughout the growing season as nectar plants because you have multiple generations of the monarchs, and the adults need the nectar. And you don't want to have just the plants for the caterpillars. You want to have a broad
range.
Exactly.
Faith in River Falls. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Sure. Hi. Question for Neil. I have a probably 15-acre prairie that is over 10 years old now. And when it was younger, we saw black-eyed Susan's very prolific. Probably the first 2 years. What's with those? We haven't seen a lot since.
Faith, you are a victim of ecological succession.
Yeah.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Yes, a common malady in prairies. What happens is the black-eyed Susan, Rudbeckia hirta, which is commonly a part of prairie mixes because it's a beautiful plant and also because most of your perennials in the prairie mix take 3 to 5 years to mature. So I tell my clients it's going to be 3 years before you see any flowers, and lo and behold, the biennial black-eyed Susan shows up in year 2, and I look like a genius. So it's all a matter of expectations. The problem with the black-eyed Susan, the Rudbeckia herda, is that it is biennial, and the seeds require open, disturbed soil in order to germinate and grow. And once your prairie forms a solid sod, which usually occurs 3, 4, 5 years down the line, the black-eyed Susan starts to disappear. And in a mature prairie, you will only see black-eyed Susan in areas of disturbance, where maybe an animal has dug a hole or something happened, and you have a disturbed soil area, and their dormant seeds will come up. And I had a very interesting experience many years ago. I used to go all around the three-county area where our nursery is in Marquette County, collecting seed in the ditches. This was in the old days. And I ran across a field where someone had just planted new pine trees. And they used a tractor with a V-plow to open the ground.
Yeah.
And right along the lines where the little red pines had been planted, there were all these rows of black-eyed Susan. Because the soil had been opened and disturbed, the dormant black-eyed Susan seeds had germinated. How long had it been since black-eyed Susan's been there? 30, 40, 50 years? Who knows? And there were these little stripes of black-eyed Susan all down the field. It was really quite interesting to see that. So,
very, very cool.
Okay, thanks, Neil. That's what I needed to know.
Okay, right. Good luck, Faith.
Thanks, Faith. Tim and Eau Claire, hello. Thanks for calling.
Hi, question for you. I have, at my old house, we had Solomon seal, which I believe is native, growing like wheat. I mean, it was all over the place. And I absolutely fell in love with it, but I don't know if it's something that I can do a cutting of, or if it's something where I need to get seeds, or if it's something that I can even move or touch, if it is, you know, native or invasive or endangered or anything like that.
Tim, you can do all of the above. If you have a friend that has some, you can dig them up when they're dormant and divide them. They're rhizomes. Or you can grow them from, you can collect the seeds. How tall are these, Tim? Are these in the woods or in the sun?
These were in shade.
Okay. And they had red seeds?
It's a piece of woods that had never been touched for 40 or 50 years.
Okay.
And they were anywhere from 3 to 5 feet tall.
3 to 5 feet tall?
Wow.
They were huge.
Wow. Okay. Now, did it
but
have?
Then again, we had tiger lilies planted, and those would grow taller than I am, and I'm
okay.
You know, 5'9", 5'10". I mean, it was great soil there.
Okay. Did it have red seeds or purplish black seeds?
I couldn't tell you because I never really looked at the seeds. I guess
were the seeds at the end of the plant or dangling from the arching stem?
Oh, it's been so long, I don't remember.
And where were you on the evening of the 17th? Okay.
The thing is, my ex-wife had took the house when we divorced.
Okay.
And I'm now thinking, God, I missed those.
Can you get joint custody on the flowers?
No, but somebody else owns the house now.
Oh, okay.
To let me separate them.
Okay, well, you could, if you ask the new owner, you could go there in the fall after the leaves turn yellow. And
okay.
Dig down about 6 to 8 inches, and you will find these white rhizomes. And break them into pieces about 6 inches long and just plant them at the same depth as you find them, usually about 2 inches under the soil. And you know, pack them in nicely in the soil. Don't compact it, but pack the soil well around it. And then put 3 or 4 inches of fresh leaf litter on top of that to protect it over the winter. And they should come up in the following spring. Or you can buy them from a reputable nursery, such as Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, if you so desire.
Any leaf litter I need to stay away from, oak or maple or anything like that?
I don't think so. The only thing you might want to be concerned about would be black walnut. But oaks, maple, I use oaks, maples, elm, you know, whatever I've got I throw on there. I do avoid the black walnut, however.
Judith said that she found that after they don't do well right after transplant, but then they come back fine the next year.
Yeah, it takes them a year to get established after you disturb the roots. She's absolutely right. Yeah.
Yep, there you go, Tim.
Thanks so much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And, boy, we have open lines. We can get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. I want to go back to your catalog for a minute. I always enjoy this catalog, Neil. You know, so of course it's new every year, and a beautiful front cover, which is really enticing. But lots more inside. Tell us about that.
Well, our catalog is, we try to make it a compendium of as many garden-worthy native prairie and woodland plants as possible. And we started out as Prairie Nursery 42 years ago, and we've branched into more woodland plants. So now we have woodland ferns, sedges, and many, many woodland wildflowers. We also have plants for moist areas, not like aquatic emergence that grow like in lakes and things, but right at the edge. So we have pre-designed gardens that people use, whether it's for birds or for butterflies, specifically designed to attract these sorts of critters. We have shoreline restoration gardens to help stabilize shorelines along lakes and streams. We have seed mixes for all different kinds of situations, whether it's dry sandy soil where you really can't grow anything except a good, nice prairie.
Yep.
We have seed mixes for clay, seed mixes for moist areas, low-growing, tall, pretty much anything that you could need.
And people can get a copy of these. Well, actually, just go online to your, I imagine, theprairienursery.com.
Yeah, www.prairienursery.com. One word, prairienursery.com. Or you can give us a call at
1-800-476-9453. 476-9453 with 800 ahead of it. 800-476-9453.
Or 1-800-GROW-WILD. But I hate it when people use those letters because you can't figure out what number it is. So we don't use that anymore.
Scott in Marshfield has a question for you. Hi, Scott.
Hey. I was wondering, I've heard there's a decline of bees to help pollinate everything. And I was wondering, is there a good prairie mix that would keep flowers colorful, everything like that, that would keep the bees around year long that just would help everything going?
Scott, you're absolutely right. Not only are bees in decline, but lots and lots of native pollinators are in decline. Studies have been done showing that in some areas we're down to maybe 50% of the pollinators that we had 40, 50 years ago, primarily because of loss of habitat and also because of pesticides and insecticides in particular. So if you get a good balanced prairie mix that has a wide variety of flowers that will bloom spring, summer, and fall, that is really the trick to supporting a wide variety of pollinators. You want to have something that's going to be there throughout the season in order to support not only different species, but in the case of butterflies, different flights of butterflies, like the monarch butterfly and the Karner blue butterfly, which have about three flights a year, I think, three generations a year. So you want to make sure you have a diversity of blooms, many different species, and it bloom at different times of the year. And if you really want to get serious about this, if you have woodland areas, you can plant woodland wildflowers that bloom earlier than the prairie flowers, providing nectar sources and pollen sources for your very early season pollinators. Interestingly, the honeybee is a warm weather bee. It doesn't come out very early. And for a lot of pollination, we rely on native pollinators that are more cold tolerant that will come out weeks before the honeybee. So a lot of people are worried about the honeybee, but we should be concerned about all of our pollinators.
All of them.
Because 33%, 34% of the food we eat depends upon pollinators. So if you want to eat, you better take care of those bugs.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Scott. Really appreciate your call. Kellen Sugar Camp. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering what that beautiful grass I see in woodlands and along the edges of woodlands with a little more sun. It's long, dark green, very graceful, maybe 8 to 10 inches, and it just kind of cascades down. I don't know what it is, and I see it everywhere on the edge of the woodlands or open woodlands.
8 to 10 inches high?
No, the grass blades are about 8 to 10 inches long. And they just kind of weep. They grow up about 4 or 5 inches, and then they kind of weep over. It's just beautiful grass. But I usually find it in open woodlands.
And you're in northern Wisconsin?
Yes.
Yep, Sugar Camp.
Well, can you send Larry a picture on his Facebook page?
Oh, I wish I could now.
Yeah. How tall is the plant itself?
I think it probably gets to 6 to 7 inches before the blades start to fall over, and it just looks like little waterfalls of green. It's just beautiful.
You know, it's hard to say without actually seeing it. Might possibly have a sedge.
Oh.
Which is a group related to grasses, but not grasses.
Yeah.
They're in the Cyperaceae family as opposed to the grass family. And does it have really broad leaves, like inch wide?
Oh, no, it's not that wide.
It's not that wide. Okay.
Oh, 1/8 of an inch.
Okay.
Oh, so really.
Yeah. It's just beautiful.
It might be a sedge. It's really hard to see. There's 118 species of sedge in Wisconsin and many, many woodland grasses, so it's kind of hard to tell without seeing it. But
To be quite honest, when I grew up in Janesville, I used to find it in the woodlands there, too, and now I'm north of Rhinelander, and I see it here.
Oh,
It's really, I don't know what it, but it would make great kind of like understory, like if you had lots of trees along the edge of your property would be just beautiful, like to replace like grass or something.
Yeah. Well, that is what a lot of people are doing. In fact, using our native woodland grasses and woodland sedges. And I'll tell you an interesting story. Is I have a 20-acre buckthorn and a garlic mustard farm, and slowly but surely, winning the war against these terribly invasive plants. And what I have found is there are some plants that I can use to greatly retard the growth of garlic mustard. And one of those plants is long-beaked sedge. And I planted areas of this. This is Carex springelii. Beautiful, beautiful arching sedge, beautiful drooping seed heads. And where I planted that about, they form nice clumps. And where I plant them about 9 to 12 inches on center, once they're established, there's very little room for the garlic mustard to come in. And right around that patch, there's garlic mustard, but inside that patch, there's very little. I've also used a grass that's not native to Wisconsin. It's a more southerly grass. It's called Northern Sea Oats, Chasmanthium latifolium, which occurs in central Illinois, about as close as it naturally gets to Wisconsin. But with our warmer winters, it didn't used to be that hardy, but I've been kind of killing it off and selecting the seeds off the ones that survive. It's just natural selection. And it's done quite well for me. And once that's established, it keeps garlic mustard out completely. And it's beautiful grass. But, beware, it's not a native Wisconsin species if you're concerned about that.
All right.
Does it work for goldenrod?
No, that's a whole other thesis.
Okay. That's
all
I asked.
Oh, man. Thanks a lot for calling, Cal. Appreciate it. Is there anything for goldenrod? That's what the next person is going to say.
Well, there's good goldenrods and bad goldenrods.
Yeah.
And we do sell many goldenrods, but we have only nice goldenrods at Prairie Nursery. Mm-hmm. And there are some bad boys out there. Probably the one that most people are thinking of is the Canada goldenrod. And that is a highly invasive plant, not only by seed, but by underground rhizomes. And it just takes over. And interestingly, a client of mine who I think inadvertently did phenomenal research on this, Dr. David Atwell in southwestern Wisconsin, west of Madison, had an edge of woods where he had Canada goldenrod that blew into the prairie that we planted for him and became established. And he has mowed it. He found that by mowing it 2 years in a row, twice a year, once in late June and once in August, late August, as it was going into flower. He did that 2 years in a row, and it has been gone for 3 years.
Oh.
So it is in remission, as they say. So
wonderful.
This is what happened at his property. And I mean, it was, and the prairie plants, because they were only mowed twice and because he mowed it at about 6 inches, he didn't take all the vegetation off. The Canada goldenrod, most of the leaves are above the 6 to 12 inch area. So height, I should say. So he mowed off all the leaves on the Canada goldenrod, but many of your prairie grasses and flowers have leaves at the base. So they weren't as harmed as the Canada goldenrod. So we're doing that 2 years in a row, once in late June and once in late August.
Bang.
I mean, he just nailed it. No chemicals, no herbicides, nothing.
Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, our guest today. You can go to my website at my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We've got a link to his site, which is www.prairienursery.com. And Don in Williams Bay has a question for you about sedges. We talked about sedges just a minute ago. Let's go there. Hi, Don.
Hi, Larry. Enjoy your show. And Neil, first before I mentioned, I used your no-mow mix. Gosh, about 12 years ago, with great success on an area of my farm.
Wow, great!
That's been a great cover. But anyway, the last caller, sort of after my own heart, I have some Pennsylvania sedge in a little wooded area, and it's one of my favorite grasses. And I'm wondering, can I separate it and spread it to make it spread, and if I just collect the seed, which I think mainly is late May, early June, what's the best way to germinate that?
I wouldn't even try. First of all, let's address your first question. The way to propagate Pennsylvania sedge is by division, by root division.
Oh.
And you can just go out there with a shovel and take out like a 6x6 chunk of it with the soil, 2 or 3 inches of soil, and move it to a new location to establish it.
Okay.
You got to take a pretty good piece because the rhizomes are very fine and easily disrupted. So you need to get a big chunk of it. So take it like a 6x6 square and then move somewhere else. And
forget about trying to propagate it, though.
Well, that would be the propagation method, yeah. But you wouldn't – propagating from seed. First of all, have you collected any Pennsylvania sedge seed yet, Don?
Last year I did, but I haven't done anything with it.
Okay. Did you notice how much each plant produced? Not much.
Very,
right?
Very fine.
Yeah. It's a huge effort to collect that seed. And it is one of the more – I've had difficulty germinating it. And it only produces seed in odd years, so the chances of even getting – you got lucky last year. A lot of years it produces little or no seed. So seed is a really, really, really tricky way to do it. So I would suggest you go with the division, just take a chunk of it and plug it in.
The easy way.
All right.
Way easier, and you'll get faster results.
Okay, I'm all about easy. Thanks.
All right,
hey, good luck,
Don. Jim in River Falls. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for a wonderful program. And my cell phone is getting a little low, so I'll ask the question quick. Actually, I have two questions. I've got some prairie that I've established 12 to 15 years ago in the River Falls area, and I just de-enrolled it to CRP. And they've got a plan in there that I need to, they wanted me to mow it this year and in 5 years. And typically I've been burning it, but with the snow cover this year, I'm not sure that even if I wrote a plan for burning that I could do it this year prior to May 15th. But I'm just wondering what the advantages of one versus the other would be. And then also, I've got some property up in Rust County near the Chippewa River, and it's pretty sandy, loamy soil. It's very sandy. I'm just wondering what sort of type of grasses or prairie cover would work up there and be native to that area.
Okay, let's start with the burning and the mowing question. You may find that once the snow melts, especially in your River Falls property, is that a pretty sandy area, Jim? Are you still there by chance? Nope, he's gone.
Yeah, I'm still there.
Okay. Is it sandy?
There's some clay. It's kind of silt loam and some clay, I guess.
Okay, so it's not a dry soil. Okay, so it's going to take a while for it.
Real dry.
Okay, it's going to take a while for it to dry out and become flammable. You might be able to burn before May 15th, but it depends on how the weather progresses. Once that snow is gone and things start to dry out, you might still have a chance at it. If you look at the difference between burning and mowing, especially on medium or mesic soil, such as your silt loam, clay loam, sandy loam soil, in that situation, we have problems primarily with invasion of the prairie by cool season grasses and weeds, as well as trees and shrubs that we don't want in the prairie, because, of course, if the trees grow up, then you don't have a prairie anymore because of the shade. So, typically, the preferred method of management is to burn that prairie in mid-spring. And the best way to select the timing on that is when the buds of the sugar maple tree are opening, which is later than most people think. A lot of people are burning in early April. That doesn't do much because you want to wait for the undesirable cool season grasses like quackgrass, bluegrass is a weed in the prairie, brome grass, things like this. You want to wait for them to get about 6 inches tall and then you burn because this does maximum damage to them with minimum damage to the prairie plants. The prairie plants, most of which are warm season plants, are just emerging or still dormant under the soil when the buds of the sugar maple tree are opening. The cool season weeds and grasses are actively growing, and they will be severely damaged by the fire. If you can't burn, then you can mow. But if you're going to mow, you want to mow right to the ground. And a typical rotary mower does not do a very good job of this because it leaves 2 or 3 inches of stubble. So that's 2 or 3 inches of green growing material of the bad guys that you leave behind. If you can get a flail-type mower, which will mow right to the dirt, that is the preferred option for mowing as a substitute for burning. As far as your northern Wisconsin area, there are really both options here. We have northern grasslands that have a different set of grasses than our southern prairies. But on dry, sandy soils, you will find southern prairies growing in northern Wisconsin or components thereof. In fact, you can go up to the Mukwa Barrens up in Bayfield County. And it's just like being in a prairie because it's super dry sand. It's a very hot and dry environment. And so it's able to support more southerly prairie flowers and grasses. So based upon your soil type, you can select the species accordingly.
And thank you again for that. Marcus in Nakusa, I want to give you a chance here to join in. Hi, Marcus.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Larry. Question for Neil. My wife and I just bought a house last summer in Nakusa, and it seems to be very dry. And we're looking to get some trees planted in front of the house for shade. And I'm looking for a native tree. I was thinking along the lines of like a bur oak or something like that, but something where I don't always have to, if I forget like a watering or something, to keep them moist for that first summer, it's not just going to die just because it's so dry.
Okay, well, I'm going to encourage you not to forget to water that tree in the first summer because it might die. The trick to trees is the first year is absolutely critical, and if you get two successive years of hot, dry weather, you're going to need to water in that second year too because it takes a while for the trees to develop good deep roots. Even a tap-rooted, drought-tolerant tree like the bur oak, which is probably a very good choice for your situation, you really got to help it out to get established in the first couple of years. So bur oak is good. Tell me a little bit more about your soil. We're going to get into a little details here. Do you know if it's a sandy loam, a loamy sand? Do you know the textural analysis on this?
It's very sandy. Okay. I grew up kind of over towards the Marshfield area where it's clay.
Yeah.
Where you could pretty much grow anything because the water retention would hold.
Right.
But down by us, I mean, our lawn, after a week of no rain, it's turned into no mow.
Turned into brown mow. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and you know, and a lot of people use our no mow lawn mix on dry sandy soils like yours because it's so much deeper rooted. And it's a great solution for sandy soils. So you might want to look at that, consider that. But as far as trees, the bur oak is a good choice. It is quite drought tolerant. On super dry sandy soils like yours, it's going to take a while for it to get its root down where it's going to really be self-sufficient. You have, you're pushing the envelope on the white pine. I don't know if you're looking for only deciduous trees for the situation.
I'm open to both, I guess. It'd just be nicer to have that winter sunshine through.
Yeah,
you know.
Of course. Yep. No. Actually, there are some red maples. The red maple is a strange tree. And there's some interesting hybrids of the red maple where they cross it with silver maple. And there's some nice trees in that. But the red maple itself, although not a very sturdy tree, is bimodal in its distribution. It occurs at the edge of wetlands and it occurs in dry sandy soils. But in middle, medium, good soils, it's non-existent. Yeah. It's a strange plant. Yeah. So that's an option as well. But I'm preferential to bur oaks because that is one of the best trees you can plant.
They're beautiful trees.
And they're super tough. They're just amazing once they're established. But give it time. Give it 2 or 3 years of help before you can set it off on its own.
Thanks, Marcus. Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest today, Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery. Just to mention, next week on Garden Talk, Patty Nagai, hort educator for Racine County with Extension, joins Judith for some special tips for brand new gardeners and advice for all of us. Really, I will be in Hawaii at that time.
Hey.
Yeah, with a group of Wisconsin Public Radio listeners. Wife and daughter and I will be looking at some flowers over there. I can tell you that for free. looking forward to that. And looking forward to hearing what Joe in La Crosse has got to say. Joe, hello. Thanks for calling.
Hello. First quick question. Is a no-mow grass acceptable over a drain field? And secondly, we live on a slope of timber that faces southeast and drops 100 feet or so down into a little creek. You've mentioned wildflowers in the forest. That's quite intriguing. Could you expand on that?
Absolutely. I want you to hold on the line because I'm going to have a couple questions for you. Okay, Joe?
Sure.
First of all, to answer your first question, yes, you can put the no-mow over your drain field, and in fact, you can plant a prairie over your drain field.
Mm-hmm.
And studies that were done by the DNR back when they were in charge of drain fields and wastewater treatment, I talked to some guys who had exhumed over 100 failed septic systems. And out of all those 100, never once did they find a failed septic system caused by herbaceous plant roots. Tree roots, yes. Shrub roots, yes. But herbaceous flowers and grasses, never.
Never.
And we've used them.
They help the drainage around the pipes then, obviously.
Well, theoretically, they may be taking up some of the moisture down there because of their deep roots. I planted a prairie on top of our drain field 32 years ago and never, ever had a problem with it. So it's that's – and in fact, the tank failed last year. And because and they checked the drain field, they said the drain field is perfect. It's 32 years, the drain field is perfect. Except, guess what? The laws have changed. and your drain field is no longer in compliance because of the distance to groundwater. So you have to put in a $10,000 mound system with a new tank. Isn't that wonderful? The drain field is perfect, but it's no longer in compliance. So too bad, buddy.
Oh, man.
Anyway, so yes, you can do that. But as far as your woodland situation, the first question you would want to, there are two questions you want to ask about woodlands, besides the fact of the slope and the direction of the slope, is what are the trees in the overstory and what is your soil type?
Okay, we're on a hillside. We're actually up right against the Yellow River State Forest. Our property abuts it, and the forest comes into us. It's natural. It's been disturbed for a number of years, and it's about a 50 or 60 degree slope with several outcroppings.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay.
And it drops about 100 feet down a little creek that runs into the Yellow River.
Okay, are these
over in Iowa by effigy, actually.
Okay, are these limestone or dolomite outcrops or sandstone outcrops? Do you know?
I think they're limestone.
Okay, that's pretty typical in that area.
Yeah, kind of clay soil and a lot of rocks all through it, that kind of thing.
Okay, so
you
have...
My big question is, too, you know, nobody's walked down there or been there for a decade.
Right.
And there's quite a bit of undergrowth, and in, you know, through the summer, all the vines come up and the thistles and all that. And how do you get into it, and what should you do?
Okay, so you have vines and you have thistles in there. So,
well, not down there, up on the little pasture where our house used to be.
Oh, okay. We have two.
Brambles, that kind of thing.
Oh, okay, like raspberries and blackberries?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sounds like you have two very distinct different situations here. One is in the woods where you have a canopy of trees, and you probably don't have a lot of the thistles and brambles. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay,
right.
And then you have this more open area where you have the thistles and the brambles, which need more sun. Is that an accurate description? Okay.
Exactly. Defined line, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So you're more concerned about the woodland area, not the brambly thistly area, is that correct?
Yeah, because we need to mow the upper part that for the, you know, the house and so on.
Sure.
And, but you mentioned planting wildflowers for insects, bees, etc.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in the woodlands. I find that quite intriguing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The first thing you want to do is get to know your soil a little bit better. It sounds like you have clay over rock, and in some cases, because of your limestone or dolomite outcrops, it could be very thin soil. So you want to evaluate the depth of the soil, because the plants that you select for growing, you'll want to make sure they have sufficient rooting zone, or that you select plants that don't need a deep rooting zone. For instance, one of our lowest maintenance and wonderful plants is the wild ginger, and it forms a natural ground cover that keeps out garlic mustard, buckthorn, honeysuckle, etc. And it will grow in 2 or 3 inches of soil over the rock, dolomite or limestone. It likes that alkaline soil. If you have a deeper soil, then you can plant something like trilliums or the Solomon seals that the gentleman was talking about earlier, a wide variety of other flowers that you can add in. There's actually a surprising number of asters and goldenrods that grow in the woodlands that give you fall color and provide pollen and nectar for insects late in the season, because most of your woodland wildflowers, like the bloodroot, trillium, wild geranium is another good one. These are heavily utilized by early season pollinators, but they don't do much in the latter part of the season. So by including some woodland asters and goldenrods, you round out the season of availability of nectar for your woodland pollinators.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
You bet. If you have to check out our website at prairienursery.com, and you'll see a whole section on woodland plants, and then you can get a better idea of what's available and what might be best for your situation. I just mentioned a few there, Joe, but, I mean, there's
a lot.
Lots more you could look at. Do a little homework and see what you think would work best for you.
Rick in Fort Atkinson has a question for you. Hi, Rick. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I planted a prairie at my parents' house last year, a brand-new house, and in the fall of 2012, I sowed a bunch of prairie seeds and tall grass species. And then the spring, those kind of came up. I saw some black-eyed Susan and some other stuff looked like they'd be good, but a whole bunch of sweet clover and thistle really came in there. And I whacked back all the thistle, but I'm just curious. I should have mowed it last year, but I didn't. I didn't have a bush hog. This year I do. Like, when do you mow it to make sure that you're not going to be mowing the desirable species?
This is an excellent question, Rick. So stay on the line, because I have a couple more questions for you.
Okay.
Did the sweet clover make flowers and seeds last year?
Yeah, it did.
Uh-oh. That's bad. Sweet clover is a really, really nasty biennial weed. And one of the problems with sweet clover is that the seeds are stimulated to germinate by burning. So our magic bullet burning is nullified by this horrible weed, which was brought to you courtesy of the Soil Conservation Service in the drought of the 1930s because it has a high nitrogen fixing capacity and grows in extremely poor dry soils. But that cat got out of the bag and is causing no end of problems. How do you deal with it? You have to mow down the sweet clover right after the flowers have bloomed. Mow it at 12 inches to make sure you mow off all the leaves and all the flower heads or what are becoming seed heads, but you have to hit it right after it completes flowering or it will start to form seeds. Most sweet clover at that stage will not have any leaves below 12 inches. That leaves 12 inches of the prairie vegetation unmowed and unharmed. Yes, you're going to knock down some prairie plants, but you're not going to kill them. If you mow sweet clover, and it comes in both yellow and white, two varieties.
I've got both.
Yep, okay, great. Lucky you. But they're going to be about the same. Sometimes the yellow will bloom a little later than the white, so you might have to do this twice. But you mow them down right after they finish blooming, before they can form seed, and that will typically kill the plant. The problem is you've got the seeds from last year that are now going to come back to haunt you in future years, so you're going to have to keep at this for quite some time. I had this very same problem at my prairie, at my house, which I planted 24 years ago now, and I had a solid stand of sweet clover in the second year. I mowed it all down. I am still pulling the occasional sweet clover out of that prairie. And I have a zero tolerance policy on sweet clover in that prairie. And every year I have to go out and it's an acre. So I spend maybe an hour a year pulling sweet clover.
Uh-huh.
So you got to keep on this stuff. Don't let it get away from you.
There you go.
The question I have for you is that, so I understand sweet clover is great for a forage species. We have sheep. Ever hear about anybody grazing sheep on prairies? Is that just disastrous, or can that work out all right?
I wouldn't put sheep in there because they like to rip everything out by the ground, and they can be very deleterious to the root systems. You might turn them in there for a very brief period of time and then move them off, but I wouldn't keep them in there to the point where they're taking it down to the ground because they do, you know, they rip plants out by the ground as opposed to cattle, which just clip it off.
They just clip it off. Oh,
yeah.
Goats?
And the sheep, that's why cattle ranchers hate sheep ranchers because they destroy the range.
Yeah. Goats, maybe.
Goats, wonder goats. Love the goats. Save your trees. Don't let the goats get after your trees.
Oh, man. Neil DeBoe, our guest today. Neil is the president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Again, you could go to his website. The website is www.prairienursery.com, and you go to the site. There's a lot of great educational material there, and also you can get a copy of his great catalog. Stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On this edition of Garden Talk, we're visiting about native plants. They add so much beauty and interest to a landscape, and also they create a healthy habitat for all kinds of wildlife, including all of our pollinators, or many of our pollinators. Larry Mueller here. So glad you could join us today as we visit with Neil DeBoe, who is from Prairie Nursery, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Neil, great to have you back.
Thank you, Larry. Great to be here.
We love to talk with Neil, and certainly he loves to answer your questions when you call at 1-800-642-1234. And you can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Just looking at my Facebook page, there's some beautiful photo of prairie anemone. Grows at Ed's home in Genoa City. Isn't that pretty? I like that plant. And what else have we got here? We got partridge pea plants blooming from one of their production fields. And then we've got some butterflies on some milkweeds and Kurt Westbrook, one of my good buddy, sent us a shot of a common milkweed. That's a beautiful photo.
Beautiful in seed, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just like magic little floating ballerinas or something.
Yeah, he's a great photographer too, so that helps. That helps a little bit sometimes. Becky in Amherst Junction has a question for you. Let's go to her. Becky, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've just recently purchased a 2-acre plot that I'm going to be building on this summer. And it was soybean. It was a soybean field. So
I want to put part of it, you know, a good portion of it into prairie, but I don't think we'll be ready to do that in the spring, probably in the fall. So I have two questions. One, is that a good time of year to do it? And the second question is there assistance out there to, like, help plant a prairie or to help someone know how to do it, to plant it and keep it up?
Sure. First of all, this is a really, really good question. You're in an optimal position since this field was in soybeans last year. Soybeans typically have very low weed densities, especially if they used Roundup Ready beans where everything is completely nuked away. What you do not want to have happen here is if you're going to wait until the fall to seed your prairie, you do not want to let this go fallow and grow up to weeds. So you want to make sure that you prevent weeds from becoming established. The simplest, most effective way, frankly, is just to spray it three times this year with glyphosate herbicide, i.e. Roundup. That way you don't disturb the soil. You can also go out and disc it constantly every 3 to 4 weeks to kill weeds as they germinate. But the problem with that is every time you disc the soil, you will bring up more weed seeds. So it's kind of self-defeating. Whereas if you use a fast-deteriorating herbicide like glyphosate to just kill it, you won't be bringing up more weed seeds. You'll actually be reducing the weed seed density in the soil. You can then go out in the fall and scatter your seed on the surface of the soil without tilling it. This only works in the fall really well, and the seed will then work its way down into the ground over the winter with a frost heave action of the soil and then germinate the next spring. So this is a very, very effective method where you can minimize the amount of weed growth on the field and also get good germination without actually tilling up the ground. Now, we do generally recommend that if you're going to use this no-till method and scatter the seed on the surface of the soil, a kind of an insurance policy would be to put about 1 to 2 inches of clean straw, like a winter wheat straw, chop it and blow it. Have a landscaper come and chop and blow it onto the ground
clean
over the seed.
Clean straw.
Clean. Yes, don't do what I did the first time I planted a prairie. I was renting this farmhouse from a guy, and there was this hay up in the mow, and I said, gee, Bill, can I use this hay? Can I buy the hay? Take it away. I don't care. It's been there for years. So here was this prairie area. I had killed all the weeds off all year, put the seed down, and covered it with hay, and it turned into a huge, giant weed pile. All I did was go in there and cut weeds off. You never pull the weeds the first year because you rip up the little prairie seedlings with the weeds. So I had to cut them with a pruning shears on a tenth of an acre. It took forever.
Oh.
Learned my lesson the hard way. So winter wheat typically has the least seeds because it's planted in the fall when very few weed seeds germinate. And you get very low weed density. So after you scatter the seed on the surface of the soil in the fall, if you can cover that just enough to cover the surface of the soil after the seed has been planted, cover that with the chopped and blown winter wheat. Chopped and blown so then it doesn't blow away.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you just take a bale of straw and scatter it around, all it takes is it's loose and the wind blows it away and it doesn't do you much good. That will then help hold the moisture in the ground the next spring when those seeds are germinating.
There you go. Thank you, Becky, for calling.
And if you need help, hey, you can call us at Prairie Nursery. You can give me a call at 800-476-9453. We help people all over state and all over the Midwest.
800-476-9453. Or you can go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, too. We've got a link, certainly a good link there to his website. Anna in Mayville, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. My husband and I are brand-new homeowners in town and brand-new at gardening, too, and we wanted to do native wildflowers, but we don't know where to start, and we just have a flower bed that we covered in leaf litter last fall. So we were wondering how to get the most bang for a buck. Should we do seeds or start from plants with our flower bed?
All right.
Okay. If it's a small flower bed, you're almost certainly going to be better served to put in transplants rather than seeds. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, seeds are best used on large areas where it is cost prohibitive to put in plants. It would just be too expensive to go out and plant an acre to plant, especially if you put in typically one plant per square foot. 1 acre is 43,560 square feet, so that'd be 43,560 plants. And even at, you know, $1.82 a plant, you're talking real live money. Now, yeah, there are people that do this, and we're very thankful for those customers, but that is not the average customer. So on a small area, transplants are always the best way to go because it allows you also to place them exactly where you want them in the garden. Whereas with seeds, Well, the seeds are going to kind of maybe show up here and show up there. Even if you scatter them in little areas, you're probably going to be best served to use transplants in that area. I would suggest you check out our website for information and then give us a call. We work with customers hand in hand all the way to help them from start to finish to put in their native garden.
There you go. Thanks, great. Anna.
Great.
Yeah, appreciate your call. And he is a helpful guy. Well, I'll say that. Wayne in Rice Lake. Hi, thanks a lot for calling. Hey, Wayne. Wayne, are you there?
Oh, yes.
Hi.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, Wayne.
Larry. My question is plant identification. I have a daisy-like flower that has taken over a garden, a flower garden. I don't know where it came from. It grows about 7 feet tall. It has a rhizomous root system, and I just can't seem to get rid of it. It's very pretty, though, but it just dominates everything.
Yellow?
You know what it is.
Well, there could be many different suspects here. What color is the flower, Wayne?
The flower is yellow.
Okay, and what do the leaves look like?
The leaves are sort of triangular, pointed, very pointed.
Okay.
It has a very fibrous root stem system, and the stem will generally break before the root will come out.
Cup plant?
How wide are the leaves? Are they really, really big and wide? Like 6 to 8 inches?
Quite long, 6 to 8 inches.
And how wide?
Like I said, they're pointy.
Yeah, how wide are those leaves, Wayne? Are they
slender? They're probably about an inch and a half wide.
Okay. No. Okay. So that wouldn't be cup plant because that's a wider leaf.
The flower is probably about 3 inches in diameter.
Okay.
Very big.
You might want to look at possibly perennial sow thistle. It doesn't normally get that tall. It has a daisy-like, almost like a dandelion daisy-like flower. Is that correct?
Not a dandelion flower. It looks like a daisy, it's this huge plant that grows 6-7 feet.
I tell you what, why don't you email us? Email me at charliesam@prairienursery.com. Because we could spend about an hour trying to figure this out. You just send me a picture of it? You have a picture of it?
It's buried in the snow now, but I'm sure it will come up.
Okay. Well, you tell you what, when that plant comes up, you get a picture of that thing and send it to me, and I'll see if we can't help you with that and figure out what you got there.
Yeah. Sounds interesting, though, doesn't it?
It's probably some kind of aggressive, probably weedy aster family, and there's a lot of them. So, yeah, we'll see what you got there when it starts to really get developed.
John and Harrison, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've spent about the last 5 years up here planting a really nice vegetable garden. Well, it turns out that my wife and I have to leave the state for about 5 years. We're keeping the house up here. I wondered if your guest had any suggestions for a native wildflower mix that I could plant in that garden. We will be visiting here a couple of times in the summer, and I'd love to have some wildflowers. It's great soil. Any suggestions?
Sure. Let me ask you a couple questions. Obviously, it's a veggie garden, so it's full sun or nearly full sun?
Nearly full sun, yeah.
Okay. And great soil, meaning a nice loamy soil, rich loamy soil?
Yep. And I've done lots of additions to it over the past 5 years. So.
Okay. And what are the dimensions of this garden, John?
It's about 25 yards by 50 yards.
This is not a small garden.
No.
No, it isn't.
This is an industrial
really nice
home garden. Okay.
Man.
Okay. Are you going to convert this back to a veggie garden when you return?
Well, that's a possibility. So, you know, if I wouldn't want to break the bank, you know, sowing expensive wildflowers. But, you know, if I would be willing to spend a little bit of money to get it looking nice for a few years.
Okay, I calculate that you have 16,875 square feet, which is 0.39 acres, 4/10 of an acre.
Sounds about right.
Okay. If you were to use one of our prairie seed mixes for medium soil, and there are a number from which to choose, we have short prairie for medium soil, we have tall prairie for medium soil, we have a low-growing prairie for medium soil, and we have a diverse prairie for medium soil. You would need about 4 pounds of seed. However, there is a price break at 5 pounds. So you can get 5 pounds of seed for almost the same price as 4.
Okay.
So you're probably best served to just go with 5 pounds of seed. And depending upon the mix, the cost would vary depending upon the mix. For instance, if you went with our maximum habitat and diversity mix, you'd be looking at $745 to cover that entire area.
Okay.
If you're looking, we also have butterfly and pollinator mixes. So if you went with those, are a little bit more expensive. The pollinator mix is actually it's not that bad. The pollinator is $695, and the butterfly is $745 as well. And if you went with a classic mix that a lot of our customers use, our short prairie for medium soils, that would come in at $695, plus a little tax and shipping.
Yeah.
So that's an option. If you are going to convert this back to a garden, I wouldn't recommend putting it into a prairie, because the prairie will be hitting its stride at the fifth year, and then you're going to come in there and tear the whole thing up.
Oh, yeah.
If you're going to do that, I would suggest you consider a low-maintenance cover, like you could put in our no-mo lawn, and just put it in a low-maintenance holding pattern.
Uh-huh.
And at 0.4 acres, you seed our no-mo at 5 pounds per 1,000 square feet, or 220 pounds per acre. You'd need 88 pounds of seed, and that may be your best bet. You could, on an area like that, you could probably cut it back to like 75 or 80, because it's not for exactly a lawn. It's just a holding pattern.
Right.
That may be your best bet. You're not going to get the ecological benefits of a prairie, but you're not going to invest a lot more money. You know, you're talking a few hundred dollars for that no-mo. Well, the no-mo is going to be a few hundred dollars, but it's going to be a little less than the prairie. And you won't have to tear up your prairie, which is going to be heartbreaking.
Okay, those are good suggestions. Thank you.
Yeah, and feel free to contact us, and we can help you further if you want to go have any other questions on that.
Thanks, John. Thanks a lot for calling. Still got some time. You could join in at 1-800-642-1234 with your prairie question. Mark in Green Bay. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Neil is a graduate of UW-Green Bay, and I was the former alumni director a few years back, and he came back to pay a visit and speak at a dinner of the Retirees Association there, which I served as liaison to at the time. And he didn't talk about all these little specifics regarding plantings, but he did talk specifically about some of his experiences between the faculty and the facilities people. And the facilities people like to use chainsaws, as he shared with us, to take care of some of the trees and stuff like that. And the professors used other methods, of course, because it was an environmental university. And first of all, I would just want to thank Neil for coming back that night. He was very gracious of his time. The faculty truly enjoyed, facilities people came out as well. They truly enjoyed his time there, because he had some very funny stories. And he's willing to just elaborate for a minute or two on his experiences at UW-Green Bay. It would be more than welcome, because, after all, we were an environmental college, and I think he was the first one to burn a field at UW-Green Bay.
Oh, goodness.
Without burning down a house.
Oh, goodness. Mm-hmm. Well, these bring back some wonderful memories. I have tremendously fond memories of UW-Green Bay, and I owe it a tremendous debt for the education that I received there and the amazing assistance I got at every step from the professors, from the administration, everybody in the entire university. It was a fabulous choice for me. And, yes, you talk about the difference between some of the professors and the facilities management. I will never forget my boss, Les Redens, who said, "Neil, you can solve a lot of landscape problems with a chainsaw." And I took his advice, and I have used that chainsaw to cut buckthorn and honeysuckle and black locust. And I have become very, very fond of the chainsaw. But no, UW-Green Bay gave me and so many other students a phenomenal grounding in environmental sciences and environmental ethics, and inspired us to do what we do today. And I can't thank the university and the people there enough. And so many good times and so many great experiences.
Mark, thank you so much. It is a great school, wonderful school, and wonderful university, I should say. And I appreciate Mark for calling and reminding us of where Neil went to school. That's where he's, at least some of your schooling. You've been all over the place, haven't you?
No, most of the rest of it was hard knocks.
Joel and... Have you ever been to Moose Lake, Minnesota?
I have never been to Moose Lake, Minnesota, but it sounds like a great place.
Joel's there, and he has a question. Hi, Joel.
Hi. I would like to have a little more information on growing milkweed, especially common milkweed.
you talked about it earlier, but you didn't mention anything about the propagation of it. What's involved in planting it?
It's really, really easy to grow. Are you looking at growing it from seed, Joel?
Yes.
Okay, it's really very simple. It is a very easy seed to grow. And here's another, let's get back to some of the propagation matters here. You can take that seed and treat it for only 10 days with a moist stratification where you mix the seed with a larger volume of slightly damped sawdust, peat moss, or clean sand. Put it in the refrigerator for 10 days. You can go longer if you want, but usually 10 days is all you really need to do. And then take it out and sow it into either directly into the soil or into a flat with soil, with potting soil or with starter soil. Or you can put it into pots to start it or plugs or whatever. Make sure that you use a starting soil. You don't want a lot of nitrogen in the soil because that sometimes can inhibit the germination process. This will give you uniform, rapid germination if you give it this 10-day pretreatment of a moist stratification treatment in the refrigerator. It will usually come up in 3 to 5 days. Very uniformly, you'll get close to 100% germination, and you'll be well on your way to having milkweed plants. It really depends on when you plant it. You want to make sure it's warm. It doesn't do well in cool temperatures. It's a warm, heat-loving plant. So if you're going to plant it outside, I wouldn't put it out before May 15th probably, and you should have very, very good results. You do not have to do this pre-treatment to get good germination, but you will get much higher germination and more uniform germination by giving it the cold, moist treatment in the refrigerator.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. We had the mysterious tall yellow daisy-like flower that was 5 or 6 feet tall. Caller Maggie said, hey, maybe it's a Jerusalem artichoke.
Could very well be. That's a really good
choice.
That's
a good guess. Arlen said he thought it sounded like a woodland sunflower.
Could be a woodland sunflower as well. They're very closely related. They're both in the genus Helianthus, and they're actually native sunflowers. The Jerusalem artichoke is not native to our area, but farther west. But if you get Jerusalem artichoke, have you ever tried to eliminate Jerusalem artichoke? I have, and I did it with no herbicides. It took me 3 years to dig it out, every last rhizome and little bulb in the ground. 3 years. And it wasn't a terribly large plot, so it's a real booger if you get it in your garden.
Well, now here's Keith from Ontario, Wisconsin, he's restoring an oak savanna and is training his cows to eat the burdock and the tops of the goldenrod in late summer. So that cuts back on the reproduction of that nasty little weed.
They'll actually eat the burdock. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, old Ukrainian recipe. Things are not going well in Ukraine right now. But old Ukrainian recipe, you take the root of the burdock in spring of the second year. It's a biennial.
Yeah.
And you dig it up in spring before it starts, or when it's just starting to send up its shoots. And you cut it up and you mix it in hamburger.
And
the root of the burdock is a blood cleanser. And this is recognized. This is not just some,
Neil DeBolle-ism.
Yeah, right. Some concoction. This is well documented by medicine, and it's an excellent blood cleanser. And so the burdock is, although it's not the most friendly plant in the garden, it actually has very good use medicinally.
And a Facebook note from Patrick says, oh my gosh, they tell you not to put anything but grass on your septic system, but you can put prairie plants on it? Absolutely. Huh?
Absolutely. You bet. And you can actually, University of Minnesota has a very interesting publication on planting prairie on mound systems. There's a few species on there that are not necessarily the best for our region, but the basic concepts are very well elucidated on their website. And I think if you just Google University of Minnesota Extension prairie plantings on mound systems, you'll see the information on that.
And as you say, lots of great research that shows that absolutely wonderful use for it.
Yeah.
And again, I want to go back to your catalog, which is as beautiful as always, and something that people can go online, probably just look at it online, but you can get a hard copy too. You want a hard copy?
Yeah. Feel free to give us a call, or should I give the number again?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, at 1-800-476-9453. We're open Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Or you can go online anytime at www.prairienursery.com. And there's a sign-up. You can sign up for a catalog there, and we'll be happy to send you one.
Well, tell you what, Neil, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming by.
It's my pleasure, Larry. It's always great to be on the show. Thanks so much.
Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. What do you bet he'll come back? Of course he will. We'll have him back, and we will do this again with him. Monday at 11, I'm in Hawaii next week and the week after. So Judith's on board with me, and she'll be talking, or by herself, actually. She'll be talking with the author of an incredible biography. It's called Rocket Girl, the story of Mary Sherman Morgan, America's first female rocket scientist. Stay with us. Lots in store.